the Water Supply Project Governance Committee, and please let the minutes show that Rich Spindland, Jason Burnett, Jeannie Byrne, and Dave Potter are all present. And Rich, if you can lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Please rise and join us for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We'll now turn to public comments, and let me actually start by reading a correspondence we received from Libby Downing on June 3rd. And I'll just read this and then provide it to Arlene for the record. She writes with respect to the design-build RFP that, quote, "My take is you should hire a firm that has done a DSEL. Otherwise, their learning curve we will pay for in dollars. There's only three firms in the U.S. that qualify as having done DSEL plans. Please forget about local and get the one with experience." So I will... And come.
A small group. Tom Raleigh, I'm here as a representative for the Monterey Peninsula Taxpayers Association to set the record straight. One, the meeting Monday at the Water Management District was stated that Monterey Peninsula Taxpayers Association supported Ordinance 152, the parcel tax. In no way, shape, or form did MPTA support the parcel tax. And thank you, Mr. Potter. He was one of the board members that did not vote to implement the parcel tax either in June. And also there was another election in September when the board ignored a referendum request. We did support adding an oversight committee which with real budgetary authority, which the oversight committee, which is in existence, really has no effective oversight on finances or budget for the water supply charge. Secondly, we supported a real sunset clause, not a phony sunset clause, which was what was implemented finally. So secondly, it was come to the results, and I know Jason, you were there, and some of you were there at the workshop at Carmel Sunset Center forum, half a day forum, which it was floated the idea that there would be another $100 million or more or some other number for a public contribution for the water project. Okay? Now, this idea and concept was floated, and I remarked at the workshop that as far as our grassroots connections, and we had our organization has approximately 1,000 members on the Monterey Peninsula. We believe we're a true grassroots organization that goes back 40 years. On water issues. We see no support from our members or the people that our members contact for any kind of tax or anything that would be implemented without seeking the support of the ratepayers or the property tax owners on the peninsula. So I caution you, these ideas for real tricky, fancy ways to try and end run the ratepayers and the property tax owners will only come back to bite the organization that tries to implement them. And again, we know the Water Authority, which Jason is here as a rep, and hopefully the county will be represented sometime, and the Water Management District always likes to say transparency, we're looking to the public for help. The public spoke last year on at least two occasions, in June and again in July, submitting a referendum, and was basically ignored. You cannot ignore a grassroots organization and our membership. To do that is very risky, and it jeopardizes solving our future, our current and future water problem and our crisis. So the thing is, we're not going to go away, and unfortunately we have some new people that don't know the track record for our organization, and so I just want to set the record straight on that. There was never any support for the actual ordinance 152 that was adopted. So let's be clear about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Would anyone else like to address the Governance Committee on any item not on today's agenda? Seeing none, we will close the public comment. And unless I'm mistaken, the financial issues are not purview of the Governance Committee. The securitization structure that's been proposed by the Water Management District and the Water Authority are those two entities working together on that proposal, but it's not part of the Governance Committee. It's absolutely fine to correct the record, but I just wanted to be clear that in terms of what this body has jurisdiction over.
Right, but we understand that the 8 conditions from the Water Authority, and you're the rep from the Water Authority, one of those was public contribution.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm taking notes. I just want to be clear in terms of the body here that we don't, as a body, we don't have jurisdiction over the financial issues. Okay. We will move to agenda item 1, which is approval of minutes from May 27th and May 28th.
Move approval May 17th and May 28th.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any comment? Any public comment? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Passes unanimously. We'll move on to an update from CalAM on procurement of desalination project design build firm. Actually, Libby's comment may be also appropriate to include under this, but I'll turn it to Rich for an update.
Yeah, so a couple things. So first item was the you know, we shortlisted a 4 firms, or 5 firms, excuse me, and that was made available on our website last couple weeks ago. And then this from Monday, yesterday, sorry, I was on vacation, so I'm catching up here, but yesterday the RFP went out to those 5 firms as well, and the agreement with that RFP. So those firms now have that. They will be working on that, developing the price for us. At this time, we've not changed the schedule. We're still anticipating a receiving of those proposals in September. I forget the exact date, 17th.
17th.
Yep, September 17th. We'll evaluate that as this goes through with the new schedule from PUC, if that's still the right date. But at this point, it's very important for us to get the price. I think everyone wants to know the prices. So we're working forward in that regard. The second thing I wanted to do is that the Governance Committee had sent us a letter with 7 items, and I was going to go through those 7 items for the record here and how we handled those 7 items in the RFP. Right. And then I also have the SPI list, which is 57 items, and I'll just kind of generalize those.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Fair enough. And the 7 items, do you have something in writing that you would also?
We had not planned on it, but okay. We can if you would like that, because basically we're in agreeing to everything. So I think the way the
why don't we go through it and see if there's any.
Okay, and we can follow. Okay. So the first item was, remember to provide additional detail for the alternate cases, and our comment is yes, we revised the proposal to require additional detail we provided. So we took that as in 100% agreement with you guys. The second item was to make sure the project was a prevailing wage project. And it was before, but we've strengthened the language to make sure that there's no question that it's a prevailing wage project. And we did that both in the RFP and in the agreement, citing the appropriate codes and those things.
And sorry to interrupt, but as we go through these, if we have questions, I do have a question about that, because it came up, I think, in fact, Mr. Vega raised a question at the Water Authority meeting last time about prevailing wage. And so just to clarify, CalAM was originally proposing prevailing wage because
state revolving funds
were
required.
Receiving state funds, so it would be required anyway. And so there's a strengthening of that language, but it would have been required regardless.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And there's few enough people here that if others want to ask questions.
Can we ask a question about that real quick?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really? Has CalAM done a study as to what percentage would be saved to the taxpayer? We are talking about borrowing money at a reduced rate that's being subsidized. In other words, when another area does a water project and they borrow money at state funds, we subsidize it even though we don't get water from them. So this water money is spread through the whole state of California. So every time a water project is done, we don't know it, but we in fact subsidize that because of where the taxpayer, speaking as a taxpayer in general. So if has Cal-Am ever done a study where they say, well, you know, if we use these particular sources because we have to pay this prevailing wage, which is pretty, there are several studies that a prevailing wage job runs about 20 to 25% more than a regular job. If this wasn't money that you were getting from them, I'm certainly Cal-Am would not be living in a prevailing wage job. What support structure is the taxpayer paying to afford this prevailing wage job that goes to a specific few people in that sector? And that's really the critical thing. And it's not that we can change the rule and we can't change this, but I always believe that the taxpayer should know that there's a cost for these things. And that's what we're here for, is about what is the cost. If we're going to have these costs brought down, why isn't 20% of this project, which means we don't have to borrow an extra $40 or $50 million, not being brought to the table, or at least explained to the citizens so that they can understand that every time they do a project here, we save a little money, but when we do it over there, we pay it right back? That's really what the question is, Simon.
Yeah. And I'm happy if you want to try to answer it, but I think that the broad state policy is probably beyond what we may want to be asking of our Cal-Am representative in terms of why this, the mechanism behind the state revolving fund, and
just the cost of that. That's all.
I was going to say, I think it's sort of simple that to get the reduced funding, you know, whatever that percentage, if savings in percentage, does that offset the cost of the prevailing wage?
And to be honest, we've never done a study to look at that specifically. I mean, it's, we're talking about this, I'm not the finance person, but remember, we're using this SRF money to offset debt money, and it's roughly a half of that interest rate, and it could be even more than that, because I heard last week SRF was below 2% now.
Okay.
So you're potentially talking 4 or 5% in interest rate difference on $130 million. That's what we applied for. So it's huge.
Yeah.
Right.
Huge.
So it would probably offset the prevailing wage.
Right. And what we find here, like in our local capital projects pool, most of the jobs go to union forces. Not every job does, but a lot of them do. And so those by default, not that union jobs are always prevailing wage, but generally they're higher than the prevailing wage requirements. So there's no, at this point I wouldn't know how that the project would fall out if we did a non-prevailing wage requirement versus the prevailing wage requirement. I certainly understand the point though, and in other parts of American Water we don't do prevailing wage for some of the reasons you mentioned, but for that attractiveness of that very, very low interest rate, we believe it's worth the effort.
Can I have one follow up? The proportional amount of what we're borrowing here, $100 million, and this other part, let's say, $300 million of the total project, that's being forced up. That's what I'm getting at. There's a bigger component that's being forced up for the savings of that.
No.
Yeah. Right. I think it's a fair question. I don't think that we have the answer today. And I think that from the perspective of the governance committee, our recommendation was to strengthen the prevailing wage. What your statement is that you've, it was already included and you have taken some steps to strengthen it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Next.
Okay. So the third item on the letter, the list was the looking into the goal for local hiring. Mm-hmm. And we've done that. And I'm not going to read the local hiring requirement, but when we looked into it, we found out that it's a 50% goal for the counties of Monterey, San Benito, and Santa Cruz County, so it's not super local. I mean, it's kind of semi-regional in a way. So that gave us more comfort in the fact that it's a lot larger pool of workers. And then you know, the code, the goal does say that if it's a specialty force, they're exempt from that. So it's basically the labor pool that would be requiring this 50% goal. So we have put it in there as a goal for the project. It's not mandatory. It's not something that, you know, that if they don't meet it, they don't get the job.
But now that's applying to, like, their subcontractors. It doesn't mean the general has to be local. It just means 50% of their
labor force. Yes, that's correct. And from those.
So I think that answers Libby's question. you probably are looking at firms that have got desal experience from out of the area, but their labor force, their subcontractors will be local.
Right. Okay. And we've added language to both the RFP and to the agreement to clarify how that works, the goal. Okay. The fourth item was the addition of a 30-year net present value composition, and what we did is, I would think we talked about this at that, you know, that meeting, we weren't going to delete the 20-year, we were going to add the 30 years, and we've done that. Okay. The fifth item was providing additional language to discuss the harsh marine environment that this site will be located next to and handling corrosion, and so we've added items both to the RFP and to the technical requirements. Asking folks to, you know, make sure that they provide equipment that is going to meet the duty. And then this is actually a great comment, because if you drive by Keith's at the WPCA's plant, you see a lot of stainless steel that's corroding. So it's not just stainless steel, there's more to it than that, so we've added that. But the sixth item was not really anything for us to do, but it was more of a comment that you didn't want to apply late fees, and so we didn't, you know, no change there. And then the seventh item, I was going to turn that over to Lori to discuss.
You said that you did not apply late fees?
Sorry.
It's the other way around.
We do have late fees. We don't have a payment for early finish.
Right. Which I still have an issue with.
That's right. Yes, we did not put that into the... Sorry. Thank you for clarifying.
So the seventh item was considering a bifurcated schedule, and we did discuss that at length. And we finally determined that it was best to keep it as it is because the agreement already provides a mechanism for the design builder to get schedule relief if there are permitting delays beyond the design builder's control. And also we thought it would be detrimental to the design builder if it was bifurcated because there could be a situation where they don't meet the design schedule and are liable for liquidated damages. But at the end of the day, they need the completion date.
I think Jeannie, you in particular had...
Yeah, I still have an issue with that, and you would have to really define what kinds of things are not under their control in the approval process at the county.
Right.
Because, I mean, you would have to really look at a normal plan check would be XYZ, and if it exceeds that... You know, that would be an option for them to extend. I mean, because there are a lot of issues.
Right, and we understand that, and we feel that the agreement's written broadly enough to encompass situations like that. And what they would do is, if the design builder encountered that situation, they would notify us. We would tell them within 30 days whether we accept it or not. If we don't, they disagree, we go to mediation, we try to work it out. So there's a lot of room there for discussion. And talks about
the
rates. I don't have a problem with Lori. As harsh as Jeannie was on me the last time we were here, I certainly agree that there could be things that would crop up. So.
Were there any changes that Kellyann did make to address the seventh item?
No, we didn't make any changes.
Okay.
So do you want us to follow this up with a letter, or?
Well, if the minutes reflect your statements, then that should suffice, in my mind. If you went for the record, you know, some paper trail, I guess you could go ahead and send a letter.
I guess it's our collective judgment whether these have been met. It seems like six out of seven clearly have. The seventh one was written that we request that Kellyann consider it, so you did consider it.
It probably would be good to submit a letter from Kellyann so it's not just our recollection of minutes, but it actually is.
But the governance agreement, the way I understood it, was more send us a letter when you don't agree to do something as opposed to agreeing to do something. So that's why we wanted to double check before we just started.
I would focus that letter on the seventh point. Okay. That would be my recommendation, because it, unless my colleagues disagree, it seems like the first six have been met. It's the seventh one where it's not, you did consider it, yes, but the reason that you did not choose to make modifications, it would be helpful to have that spelled out for the public record.
But I also think that since there were some questions regarding a couple of these other items, that if you could send a letter, just include those in it.
Okay, we'll take care of that.
Okay. Any public, does that complete your?
For the seven items, and then I have a journal.
Yeah, we'll continue with those, yeah, but thank you.
So we also got 57 comments from SPI, who reviewed the RFP for us. And some of those were live, because we hadn't presented to the governance committee yet, so we didn't know which way we're heading. And some of them had to do with the detail of the proposal, and come to find out that they liked the detail, even though when you read the comment, it made it sound like they didn't like the detail. So we didn't address some of the comments in regard to the detail in the RFP. But in general, there's 57 comments, 46 of them we agreed with. And we made changes or clarified or typo corrections of those. And 11 of those we kind of agree with, but some of them didn't make a change happen. So an example would be there was a comment about pretreatment, whether we need pretreatment or not. And that's a great comment. We agree. We don't know if we need pretreatment or not. So our thought was, we're going to get the cost for it now anyway. We need to know what the cost is. It may be able to fall off the wayside later, but it's better to get the cost now than not. So we kept that in there. So in that case, we didn't agree not to take it out. They were kind of recommending. Let me go through it and see if there's other ones. I mean, they had one of them on how the RO membrane racks are ported, and they went to a way that technically is cheaper, but when we looked at their designs, they don't do it that way either. So we didn't change that. And it's very picky stuff, but we did look at every single item on the list. And we thought, with our technical team that, we're in safe ground where we are. What the next step is in the RFP process is we're going to have one-on-one meetings with each of the design build teams, both technical and legal, and we're going to ask them to tell us what their issues are technically with the RFP. So we're going to get feedback from them as well. And we'll see how they correlate. There could be some correlation. If they correlate with, hey, this is an issue we need to look at, then that would be potentially a change, and we can back to the governance committee and say, here's what some of the things are. Now, we have to keep confidentiality intact, because if one firm is suggesting something, we don't want all the other firms to know their thing. But the idea is that they all five say, hey, we don't like the way you're doing this, then we would probably consider that something we would want to change. But appreciate the comments. They were good. And like I said, 46 of them, no issue at all. 11 of them, we went through them. And like I said, a couple things we didn't really change. Like one is the mechanical seals. The seals on the pumps, are they packing seals or mechanical seals? That's way down the road. No, but it's in his comments. So yeah, we didn't address it yet. Anyway, so if there's any other questions, I'd be happy to discuss those as well. But
other questions for Rich? Well, thank you for taking the time to go through that. We did recognize that some of those comments were quite detailed, and the governance committee chose to pass those on, but not include them in the seven recommendations and to give you the leeway to do as you've done.
I have a question in regards to that list that you have there. Did they ever put how these desal plants are done in sectors, like 20%, 30%, 40%, or whatever it is? So you have these like blades, let's just call them blades or sections, that if they if to commit to a 9,000 MGD, I think they call it.
So it's 9,752 acre feet per year, or 9.6 MGD.
Here's the question that I think that should be asked in SPI, is that why shouldn't we build a 9,000, and then if that groundwater recharge project comes through, that we take that section that we don't need right now, because this is working at a less cost, and because it's not something that is obsolete. When this one goes down or this one's being fixed for repairs, that we can put this one back on as insurance. And I don't know if that's ever been studied or looked at as to one of the reasons why, and this, as a public, I look at having a bigger desal plant and these other projects, when they do them come, we can ramp this down, and it, what's the cost effect of that?
Well, I actually think that comment may be, we try to take it up now, but also on the next agenda item, which is the discussion of the June 12th workshop and how the GWR project is included in the mix.
That'd be fine.
Tom?
A quick question on the follow-up comment you made about pretreatment, you know, whether it's going to happen or not. It would seem that that would have a macro effect on the total cost of the desal. Storage and everything we saw last week, we saw the plans for tanks for storing the feed water for pretreatment. Sorry, using a Navy term for desal. But anyway, it seems like that the effect on the total cost would be so significant, you'd want to know that at some early time in the game. So I don't know, is this part of what you requested from the...
Yes, we were asking for the cost now to know it now, but it may not be needed. It may not be built in the end, depending on the quality of the source water from the slant wells. And pretreatment is a kind of a vague term, because if pretreatment for an open ocean intake desal is way more complex than pretreatment for a subsurface intake. And so we've done what we believe is the proper pretreatment for subsurface intake, which is way cheaper than would be for the open ocean intake. But we're worried about iron and manganese in particular, and then also some silt potential, and that the pretreatment would basically cover that. And we've got cost in there to have them at least provide that. They may find out, and once we have a slant test well, that we don't need that. We would still accommodate, you know, make sure we could have provisions for it in the future. You know, it's a design build, so the designer ultimately is going to be responsible for the performance of the whole plant. But we've encountered, you know, we've basically said bid on these certain items because we want to make sure we don't have a $30 million spread in cost from these different vendors, because one guy is super conservative and one guy is not. We wanted at least to start off kind of near each other and then have their expertise determine where the final pricing is.
I just hope you would absolutely positively know for sure that you didn't need a pretreatment before you start building the desal, and then find out later you need the pretreatment.
No, we would not.
Yep.
We would not. Can I address Mr. Vega's comment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Both size plants have the proper level of redundancy needed to make that plant work at that rate. So that's going to be covered. And then as part of the design build, the design builder will be moving. We size these to be scalable in themselves so that we could go up and down very easily. And so the design builder, there's really not much cost difference at all to design both size plants. We're getting that basically in the process. And the only decision we have to decide is what size do we build when he starts. So we want everything to be scalable. The skids are all the same size for that reason. One of the comments from SPI was if you pick a larger scale size, let's say a 3-point MGD skid, well, then your redundant unit's 3-point MGD, and so now you've really got a plant that's 12.6, where some of the other vendors may do 1.6 MGD skids, and so then your redundant unit's 1.6. So that's a play that the design builders are going to do, because it's a cost thing. I don't know the optimum number of units to make this the most efficient cost-wise, and that's what the design builders are going to help us with. But the flow that we get is going to be reliable at that number, regardless of the plant size.
That's what those sectors there you're talking is skids is yes. What you're talking about, where you plug in and I'm hoping that they're studying that those skids, that if we add those extra skids to cover that water that the GWR may put out, or what if they fail one year or something happens, that it can be easily replaced without having this peninsula going through this crisis again. And that's the dilemma and the cost, because they keep saying this plus this plus this, well, we have to have this anyway. It's all the same cost. Why are we doing this? That's all. And that's just a criteria that I would hope that the public would know and be informed as to the cost mechanism and what it would cost, because ultimately it's getting the price of the total cost per water down.
Right.
We don't care what project it is. I don't think the most public does that anyway. Thank you.
Okay. This is a information item for the governance committee. No action is required. Any further questions for Rich? I do have a scheduling question. So the bids are due September 17th. Before the administrative law judge modified the schedule, I thought the intent was not to award bids until the EIR was certified.
Yes.
Or there was some discussion over the merits of waiting until the EIR is certified. Now the date for the EIR to be certified is pushed off approximately 8 months. Where's your thinking with respect to when CalM may award a bid?
Yeah. To be honest, we haven't finalized what that thought is yet. Because it could be pushed out.
Right.
And one of the thoughts is if we have test well data, it'd be good to have that as part of the negotiation for the agreement, as opposed to signing an agreement and then giving test well data, and he says, oh, okay.
Right.
It's going to cost more, right? So we haven't finalized that. I think what we were thinking is the most important thing is to stay on schedule, to show everyone we're still trying to meet the deadline best we can. But I think that's going to be a discussion for future topics amongst this group, is should we be moving it out or should we be sticking with where we are? We don't want to award the contract, we believe, before we have an EIR certified. That was, we like the idea of waiting for after that was certified. But we also have a feel for what was in the old EIR, what some of the conditions are going to be. So we don't think there's a huge amount of risk. I mean, this project was studied last time.
Right.
So to be honest, we haven't made a final decision on that yet, but I understand it's kind of an important topic. Now, what we learned from San Clemente is executing a design build agreement is we budgeted 6 weeks for this one. That one didn't happen in 6 weeks either, and that was a pretty easy negotiation in all respects. So maybe the time will work out fine anyway, and just work on the course we're working on.
The second question I had was the five firms, are those, it was my understanding that the names of those firms would be made public at some point. Have they been made public now?
Lori, are those public?
They're
yet?
Posted on the website. We have a list on the project website of the shortlisted firms and their proposal managers and their contact information.
And that's on the
Monterey. That's under the watersupplyproject.org under procurement opportunities.
Okay. Thank you. Dave.
Curious, Rich, how is the language structured for the bids in terms of firm bid for X period of time? Is it through the negotiation of a definitive agreement, or is it good for a year? I mean, how does that?
Well, I think we changed that, right? It was a year at one time.
Yeah.
We brought that down to 90 days, if I remember. But
it's 90 firm, and then after 90, it's still a year, but they're entitled to escalation of construction.
Okay, so then related to what you decide to do with the EIR schedule and test well data, you're into potential escalation.
Right. But we could also put it off the due date.
Right.
Which would then...
Then buy you some...
They're doing an escalation on their side,
yeah.
Not on our side. Right.
Okay.
Okay. Any further questions or comments on this item? We will move to item three, which is review outcome of June 12th. Public Utility Commission workshop on groundwater replacement and provide direction. And just as a reminder, this was a workshop that was requested by the Governance Committee a couple months ago under the Governance Committee agreement. Category A, the first Category A decision is the GWR recommendation, that is to say whether CalAM should build a 6.4 MGD plant combined with the groundwater recycling project or a 9.6 MGD plant without the groundwater recycling project. And in that, in the agreement, we specified that the parties, namely the four entities that the four of us represent, would work to develop mutually agreeable criteria that would guide that decision. We recognized that it would be helpful to coordinate with the PUC such that they would be looking at the same criteria that we would be looking at because they too will need to endorse or approve that decision. So we did hold a workshop the PUC held a workshop at our request last week, and several of us attended. So I'll give my summary and then I'll turn it to Rich and Jim and I don't know if others, but Dave, in terms of adding to the summary. The takeaway for me is that the PUC staff are quite concerned that the mechanism that we are proposing to use for getting the Public Utility Commission to signal its endorsement of our recommendation, namely a tier two advice letter, may be a problematic mechanism. And that if we do choose to use it, we need to make these criteria completely objective, so that any judgments that have to be made need to be made before the issuance of the CPCN and cannot be relegated to a tier two advice letter. In other words, and we heard the PUC staff say this a dozen times, that it needs to be a checkbox. It needs to be completely black and white whether something has been met. So, for example, the first criteria that we have, and I apologize, I need to pull this up, but the first criteria is whether the EIR has been certified. That is a checkbox. Either it's been certified or it hasn't been certified. That would be permissible. Right. But other criteria, do you mind if I look over here?
Yeah, that's the one.
We don't have copies of that.
Would you like me to make some copies?
That would probably be good.
Yeah, Dave, do you have the...
Well, which one do you want to work off of? John Farrow's recent one?
No, probably the one that... We produced one for the Water Authority meeting Thursday night. I think that would be a... Let me pull that up and I.
Is it on the authority website, or you want?
It's on the authority website for the agenda for Thursday night. The fifth item has it. But the summary again is that we need to take another look at these criteria. If we do want to use a tier two advice letter, we need to go through each of these and determine how they can be phrased such that it is simply a checkbox. It doesn't involve a judgment. And we've taken, coming out of the meeting Wednesday, we did take a first shot at those modifications, and that'll be the red line document that I believe that Dave Stolt will be bringing in. But the other concern that we are working through is the whole approach of using a tier two advice letter was something that we developed and we collectively agreed to, and it's built into the governance committee agreement. So I think that we need to take another look at that and determine whether, in fact, that is the right mechanism. The concern that we now have is that a tier two advice letter is a quick process so long as there's not an appeal. And it's a 30-day turnaround, which is the time frame that we have built in. So we specify that this decision needs to be made enough in advance of the time that CalAM needs to give direction to its design build firm such that process will not be delayed. But we built in a 30-day period for the PUC to process this tier two advice letter. The concern is that any party can appeal that and throw it into what is called a tier three advice letter process, which is a much more protracted process at the Public Utility Commission. And this could be any group that disagrees with whatever that recommendation is. If we recommend GWR not be included, it could be a group that supports GWR. If we recommend GWR be included, it could be a group that opposes GWR. And we know there are both of those groups out there in the community. And if we have to go into the more protracted Tier 3 process, it involves hearings and a period of time and the due process that the PUC goes through that would caused delay not only for the GWR project, but also for the desal project, because CalAM would be waiting and not giving direction as to which size plant to build until the PUC has completed that process. That's an unintended consequence. We want to avoid that. Our goal all along was to not add delay. I'm fearful that we may have unintentionally, by specifying a Tier 2 advice letter, opened ourselves up to that possibility. And my judgment, my recommendation is that we work to, if that is a problem, we work to fix that problem now rather than waiting a couple years from now.
I mean, if you didn't do the Tier 2, what other options are there for having it?
We have not exhausted that, the answer to that question, but that is the question, of course. A Tier 1 advice letter is something that has been looked at. There's three tiers, Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, and we thought the Goldilocks rule of Tier 2, for a variety of reasons, was the right place to end up. But the problem with Tier 2 is you can easily be pushed into Tier 3. If you make it as a Tier 1, which is really an information filing, right? If it really is just checkboxes, just CalAM would submit a series of checkboxes, and either they're all checked or they're not, it may fit within a Tier 1 advice letter, which my general understanding is it's not, as an informational item, it's not an appealable item, and it wouldn't, at least our preliminary thinking is that may be a mechanism of largely accomplishing what we want to accomplish without opening ourselves to the delay. So I think that those are the two big takeaways from the workshop. One is that regardless, we have to turn these into checkboxes. And two, even if we do turn them into checkboxes, a Tier 2 advice letter may not be the right mechanism. With that, why don't I turn it first to you, Rich, if there's anything you want to add to that overall summary.
Not really. I mean, that was the takeaway from my attendance there, was that they were looking at procedurally how to make this work. And they kept harping on checkbox the whole time. So, yeah.
Jim or Dave, any?
You're all covered.
Yeah, I would add that, given the local support for groundwater replenishment, the key stumbling blocks of where we are right now relate to groundwater replenishment. That's form of water purchase agreement. Can the form of that agreement survive enough scrutiny that it doesn't lead CalAM to want to apply what's called debt equivalence, which would then basically earn a return or put it into the rate base in a manner that would complicate and compromise the cost profile. And then what we call the externalities. It's very difficult to create a box to check if you're looking at qualitative issues where there are cost savings or benefits to people who aren't necessarily the ratepayers, and therefore it's not a rate impact or revenue requirement impact, and how do you factor those into the equation. So we, as the district, will be working with MRWPCA to try to come up with a framework for looking at these externalities and the policy objectives, the social benefit that we've been referring to. And we'll be looking at the tax and accounting issues. We have a rubric or a structure right now on how we would like to see debt equivalence dealt with that we'll be issuing a memo on shortly and work from there.
The other solution to this problem that we've encountered, and Dave alluded to it, but it is that if some of these criteria can be addressed between now and the time that the record closes in advance of the issuance of the CPCN, which we have more time now than we thought we did because the schedule's been delayed 8 months, we can take them out of a Tier 2 or Tier 1 advice letter construct and just get them into the record now. And to the extent there are judgments involved, such as monetization of externalities, if we get it into the record now, then that judgment can be taken into account by all the parties to the proceeding, by the administrative law judge, and ultimately by the commission itself. So The district and PCA are looking through these criteria and are, I think, developing a plan as to which criteria we may be able to either fully address or at least advance substantially. And as Dave referenced, the water purchase agreement is one item that we talked about at the workshop is maybe something that we could make substantial progress on in the next 8 months. The issue of the cost, what is a justified cost for the GWR project as a whole, and related to both of those, the issue of debt equivalency. If there's other items that either the district or PCA can resolve between now and the time the hearing the record closes to the current proceeding, that would certainly simplify things and I think reduce the concerns that the PUC staff have over the Tier 2 advice letter and the concerns that we have over the possible delay.
Well, it seems like if you get it down to checkboxes, it becomes simply informational. We have done this, we've done this, we've done this. So that would kick it into the Tier 1. I mean, you're not really asking for a judgment on it. You're saying it's already been done.
I think that's the direction that we're headed, like it or not, because of the PUC, the rules and the, you know, that.
Try to get all the qualitative judgment calls done before the CPCN is issued so that
the
decision can reflect it.
Okay.
Can I ask a simple, because I'm a simple man. I eat hamburgers and not caviar. So, what I heard, because I like it, I have to relate to the groups I belong to, is that if we just wanted to change the name of the plant, that's a Tier 1 letter. No consequences. No one's going to complain. The Tier 2 is because you have consequences that could change during the course, and you have to meet these criteria before they close the record, which is sometime in January. And those problem with that is that there's groups, and if you belong on this peninsula long enough, they're gonna sue. It's gonna be kicked into a Tier 3. So therefore, it probably isn't gonna make GRW, if someone threatens it with a lawsuit or pursues, it will probably go to a Tier 3, which means it won't make in the closing of the record, and it's gonna be a moot point. Not necessarily a moot point, because the water management district and the sewer district can continue to go ahead and try to GRW and come back to Cal-Am and say we got a better source of water. So it's not really a dead issue down the road. It just creates the fact that Cal-Am has to build a 9,700-acre-foot desal plant going forward with the PUC process.
Yeah, so let me clarify one point. And sorry, Tom, there's certain procedures that we have before the PUC issues its decision and other procedures after that decision is made. That decision is currently scheduled to be made in August of next year, August of 2014. Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3 advice letters are procedures that are available after the issuance of their decision. Procedures that are available to us before the issuance of their decision don't involve advice letters. We can file motions. We can use other procedural mechanisms for getting information into the record. Those procedures, any procedures that we take between now and the time the record closes, which would be early next year, there's not the concern about delay, and there's not the concern about litigation and so forth, because that would all be factored into the commission's decision in August. So to the extent that we can resolve, we won't be able to resolve all of these issues, but to the extent we can resolve some of them between now and early next year, we avoid having to put those issues through a Tier 1, Tier 2, or Tier 3 advice letter.
But I think part of Nelson's objective here is this all applies just to the sizing of the desal plant. The district and PCA could move forward with groundwater replenishment. I mean, this is just as it relates to the desal plant. It doesn't relate to moving forward with the groundwater replenishment project standalone. Well,
but in fact, the nexus is much closer than just that, because the district and the PCA would have a hard time moving forward with that project if they didn't have a purchaser of the water.
Right, but they could still move forward with that process. The go, no go really relates to how big the desal plant's going to be.
Correct, but I don't know, unless, you know, Tom wants to advocate that the district do a 218 process. I don't know how else they are going to be able to raise the close to $100 million needed, other than having a water purchase agreement with Cal-Am, and Cal-Am isn't going to enter into a water purchase agreement for that water unless it needs the water, and if it builds a larger desal plant, it doesn't need the water, at least in the near term. And so there's not the ability to finance the project, so the project.
But let's say that the desal plant is, you know, not going to get built to 2030. This would be water that was available through Cal-Am. So the intent of the go, no go was really to size the desal plant.
Right.
Okay. And if you were at the point where desal's not ready to go, then this does preconceive that the decision we made to move groundwater replenishment forward. And the opposite, if we're not ready to go as groundwater replenishment, and they say no go, about the only way you could continue with groundwater replenishment is to have all the jurisdictions suddenly say we want water for general plan build out, and here it is over here, let's keep moving. Because then they have the obligation to serve.
Come.
Tom Raleigh again, speaking for the Moderate Peninsula Taxpayer Association. Jason's heard this, and Dave's heard this at the TAC meeting of the Water Authority, that have been raising the issue periodically over almost 2 years, almost since when you guys started a year and a half ago, about delays. And the sort of scary thing is to see talk of 35 with delays, not meeting the deadlines, and not getting an extension, the 35 gallons per person per day, those of us around here with 50 gallons per person per day, and know the impacts of that. But the thing is, I listened carefully to your presentation on the last item, and I see potential delays. I participated on the REPOG that came up with the regional desal. That took 5 years from the initial scoping of the EIR at the Hyatt. I'm probably the only one in this room that was at that meeting. And it took 5 years to get the PUC to sign off on the EIR. On this list, you know, the one and four, basically, well, four is on the financing part, but one on the CEQA process, you know, knowing that the groundwater recycling thing, EIR process just kicked off really last night, I don't see, you know, unless a miracle happens procedurally to comply with CEQA and NEPA, getting a final or finished EIR on groundwater recycling before the PUC makes a decision next August. From the real world, based on the past track record, I think it's going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible. The concern is, again, potential delays. Like on the desal, we heard talk and attempt to finesse the Hopkins oceanographer. Concern about, you know, creating a desert at the outfall. It may only cost $10 million, but how long will it take to actually design and build it? I know the outfall. I had a friend I went to college with that was one of the contractors from Chicago that bid on the regional desal plant. That was years to build that offshore pipeline and the cost and to build the regional desal. Just making a modification to the outfall, it sounds easy to do conceptually, but again, what I see based on my oceanographic engineering training is possible delays. And so it seems like we keep seeing more things for potential delay. And the other thing that occurs to me, we had a lawsuit over the final EIR after it was approved by the PUC from various interests that essentially killed the regional desal, and plus no feed water for the desal plant, no proof feed water. So I think that, you know, the overriding potential for delays, I know we're all concerned about it, and the ratepayers and the communities are concerned about it, the hospitality folks are concerned about it, the whole economy and everybody's concerned about it, but I keep seeing more potential delays coming up, and I don't see a lot of these things being solved, and I think you can virtually guarantee, Jason, your concerns about someone wanting a Tier 3, that's almost a given. You know, you can almost name the suspects that will be behind that.
Right.
So, you know, this is a concern, you know, trying to represent the ratepayers, the taxpayers, and those that are CalAmp customers and are going to be paying the freight for this. Again, the cost of delay and, you know, the impact of delay directly and indirectly. That's really, you know, I just raise that alarm. You know, and I know you all know about this, but time has just been marching on. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Anyone else like to address
Just one other question, Mr. Burnett, and that's in regards to the complications of this GRW as it reflects to what the judge is going to do. Because, again, just from a simple side, I'm assuming that the judge has been given a problem how to resolve, and he's just going through this process, and if you don't have your ducks in a row, he doesn't care. He's marching forward. CalAmp, you have an obligation, you have this, et cetera, et cetera. And he's giving them deadlines because they know a 9,700 acre foot desal plant will in fact fix the problem for the State Water Resource Board. How you get there, how expensive, the judge is not really concerned with, as long as we've gone through the process of eliminating things, and ultimately he's going to make a decision, and we're going to have to live with that. Am I correct in that analysis? Well,
only that he does care about cost.
That's well, no, I'm not saying he doesn't completely care about cost. What he's saying is, ultimately, I have to make a decision. All this other stuff that it's bogged down in lawsuits, or this stuff doesn't work, and this group's here, I can't wait for all that. We're moving forward on this date, and I believe you said it was late in August. That's the drop-dead date when the judge is going to say, go forward, CalAmp, and all other things will be going, will be moved.
But that drop-dead date presupposes a checklist of criteria that can be evaluated after that date, and that's what this really centers on. What kind of leash will they give the groundwater replenishment project up to what future date after the CPCN is issued in August? So all those boxes don't need to be checked by August. The judge will say, based on what I see, if you can check all these boxes by this date in the future,
February,
then you can proceed and file a tier blank advice letter.
But what he's saying, and most of all agree, that if there is some lawsuit that's going to drag this on past that date, it would be a dead issue.
Could be.
We could all probably agree to that. Thank you. I'm just wanting to understand. Thank you.
Absolutely, and that's why we're raising this today, is to reduce or to the extent possible eliminate that risk, and that's why my recommendation is that we at least let our respective boards and bodies know that we may need to see a modification to the governance committee agreement that moves away from using a tier 2 advice letter as the procedural mechanism, given them the possibility of that leading to unintended delay. And since that governance committee agreement is signed by the four parties that we represent, those four parties would need to agree to that. Don, anything else that you think we should?
No, I think that's correct. The only thing I would be looking at the future relatively quickly is to do just an internal schedule for everything so that you know where you stand between now and next August, who has to accomplish what, so you can actually detail it and monitor it. Otherwise, time goes by and you're not there.
Okay. Speaking of time going by and any other comments on this item? Seeing none, we will close this item and move on to discussion of items to be placed on future agendas. And we have, I think, touched upon this in the past, but uh, respect to the intent to televise these meetings, should we agendize? Do we need to have direction from this body to do so, or is that something that...
No, this is an attempt to slip in the discussion under future items, just whether or not you want to be televised. It's been suggested from a couple of outside parties.
What's the cost?
There is a cost.
There's an hourly rate that AMP,
but
Access Monitor...
Because as I remember, the original establishment of the governance committee was that there really wouldn't be any cost to it, and of course that's not really true. So everything we add to it is just one more expense. So I would want to know what that cost is before we make any decisions.
It's nominal, but it's...
It's just more money?
So there's an agenda item.
So we'll add that as an agenda item and with a cost estimate. At least we're doing an audio recording, and it's my understanding that there's efforts being made to put that up on the web. It's not up yet, but that is the intent. So at least in terms of providing a record and that level of transparency, we have been doing that, and we will get that up sometime soon.
And with respect to audio, we need to close the loop with Monterey. Does your city also keep audio?
We have video. I don't know if we have audio separately.
Yeah, we're trying to determine whose server it should be on, whether we go to the cloud, whether we go to a third party, or do it on ours. So we need to find out what others are doing.
Okay. Any other items? Any items from CalAM? Okay. We will adjourn the meeting. Thanks.
Tom.